Well, I'd like to welcome everyone to our first ever live Hanover House. It's our first ever live London Lyceum episode of any sort, so I'm really looking forward to this. And I'm joined by a crew of great brothers here with me. So I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and we've got Jake Stone in the house, we've got Garrett Walden in the house, Cody Float, Jesse Owens, and Jonathan Badley in the house. So I'm really looking forward to this. Now, I'm going to give you guys a little bit of, you know, kind of a rundown how that show is going to go, because this is live. This is our first ever time doing this. So it's unique. It's going to be fun, I hope. And one of the cool things about this platform that we now have that we record on is we have this opportunity to have an actual audience. And you guys can call in live on the show, and we'll record you on the show just like you are one of the hosts. So as we go, you can send me questions whenever you want. I'll get a little notification. I can let you in the show, and you can either chat it to me or you can talk to us, like you jump in and it gets recorded. Or I'll tell you at different points, hey, anybody in the audience have any thoughts, questions? We'd be happy to take those at that time. So if you've got a burning question while someone's talking, while Jake's talking, you can go ahead and shoot it in then. But if you want to wait for when I give you the chance, that's fine too. So if you haven't listened to a Hanover House before, if you're listening now and you're not, it's not part of the live episode, you're listening on your podcast app, wherever you are, just to give you a reminder of the kind of the tone and flavor of this episode. We try to do these like once a month, and the goal behind this was most of our weekly content is we get a high-powered scholar, we ask them questions, and it's a little, I mean, we try to do it informally as best we can, but it is a little bit more formal, and this was supposed to be, these are all people we have relationship with for the most part, so it can be a little bit easier to have a just kind of unfiltered conversation at the coffee house. But don't think of this as like theology on the cheap. The London Lyceum, we are not like bottom shelf theology. There is a place for the bottom shelf. There's a place for putting the cookies on the bottom so that everybody can have a bite. That's not what our goal is. That's not what our mission is. We want to keep the top shelf cookies up there and make you reach for them, make you grow, make you stretch, and encourage you in that way. So we want to provide serious theology for a serious church. So even though we try to cut up a little bit here, we do want to keep it in like actual legitimate, intelligent, difficult theology. So before we do this, I want to introduce everybody who's here. Jake Stone, if you're not familiar with him, he's like total Baptist nerd, and now he's an MDiv student at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, and of course, it's the Southern Baptist, kind of like the Ohio State. And what you work at the library now, so he just nerds out on Baptist theses and, you know, dissertations.
Well, let's get it. If we're gonna intro right, Jordan, I work at the James Pettigrew Boyce Centennial Library at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. We try to be precise here in the Hanover House.
That's right. So I've actually got quite a bit of Baptist history nerd power here. We've also got Garrett Walden, who he is our newly minted book review editor, which I don't know if he knew what he was getting himself into, but now I send him all the book reviews and say, please read this and tell me how to make this better. So Garrett, you're a PhD student under Michael Haken at Southern as well, correct?
Yeah, that's right. So I'm in historical and theological studies track. So I take some systematic seminars, some church history seminars, but I'll primarily be focusing on 18th century Baptist history with Dr. Haken.
Excellent. And we've got Cody Float as well, who is a THM student in Old Testament at Puritan Reformed Theological Seminary, but you're also a church member at your local church. Which, how long have you been at this church?
I've been at Morning View now for 5 years.
Okay, and were you like an intern or a pastoral assistant at some point?
Yeah, so I was a pastoral intern for what kind of amounts to 3 years. We have like a formal, like bivocational program, and I went through that program, and now I'm just a church member, serving, teaching when they allow me to, you know. So, working on school. So,
excellent. And then we also have Dr. Jesse Owens with us, who, you're at Welch College, and you are also a Baptist nerd, so I'll call you out. And we've got to convince you to come on and talk about the Salters Hall controversy and an upcoming episode soon. So I'll tease everybody with that because I think that would be a tremendous time. Anything you'd like to add about your little bio or anything?
No, that's good. I pastor a church here in Gallatin, Tennessee, same town that Welch College is in. But no, that's it. Like Garrett, studied under Dr. Haken as well.
Excellent. And I think we've got Jonathan Badley here as well. He's one of our fellows. He's a PhD student at Vanderbilt. He just dropped off. I'm not sure why, but he'll probably be back. So just to give you a shout out to him. And Connor McMakin may also be joining us sometime along the route. He's doing, I know, pastoral care and counseling, you know, the real world stuff that we want to equip pastors with. But we also realize that there are a lot of church members and a lot of pastors who just have that intellectual itch that they need scratched a little bit. So that's part of what we try to do and serve, is to press forward in those sorts of conversations. So, oh, here's Jonathan. I'll see Jonathan. I told everybody you're a PhD student at Vanderbilt. Are you a PhD candidate?
Yeah, I've advanced to candidacy.
Perfect. And you're studying all sorts of Reformation sort of stuff. And I think a lot of your research is in what we're planning on covering, is just understanding the practice of communion and how different churches have approached that question, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The connection between communion preparation and ecclesiology.
Excellent. So anything I say that's completely dumb, he will be able to correct, which is great.
I highly doubt it.
So with all that introduction in tow, let's get into the topic. So I think I put out on Twitter, hey, we're doing a live episode. What would you want us to talk about? And it was a pretty close vote, but this one came out on top, was debating and understanding the nature of who should be given, I guess, access to the table at your local church. So imagine you're at your own Baptist church or your own Presbyterian church or whatever it may be. Who should be able to have access to the table? And I think in Baptist life, Jake, you can correct me if I'm wrong, there seem to be three general positions on this, where you'd have closed communion, you'd have close communion, which to me, I don't understand. Why name them that? Because that's so confusing. And then open communion. So closed communion would be the only people who can come to the table are those who are actually members at your local church. Closed communion would be, you can come to the table if you're not a member of my church, but you have to be baptized by immersion. And then open communion would be, as long as you confess Christ as Savior, doesn't matter. You can be baptized as an infant. You don't have to be a member here, etc. You can come take of the table here. Is that the right way to set the table, Jake?
Yeah, so basically, in many ways, the historical terms that were used a lot were open and strict communion, which strict communion was basically the close position. How we think of closed is really more that comes out of the landmark movement in the United States towards the middle to the end of the 19th century. But basically where you've got what falls in line is you either believe that only Baptist can come to the table, or that it's open to anyone who would profess Christ in that sense. So that would be basically, awesome. In today's landscape, that's your three main, you know, views.
Yeah, so I guess there's two main tracks I'm kind of interested in going here, and this is totally ad hoc. So if you're listening to this live right now, or you're listening to this, you know, some other time, we don't script these episodes. So when we do a normal interview, we actually prepare a lot of questions in advance. We think through our stuff. For these, for the most part, it's totally just like if I took Jake and Garrett and said, hey, let's go hang out. Let's go get some coffee. And we just started talking about a topic. So just with that in mind, these are unscripted, but I do think there's two tracks I'm interested in following. Is one, the historical view. So just thinking broadly, how did the reformers think about this question? Because I imagine if you're a Presbyterian or a different Church of England or something like that, you might have a different view than Baptistic understanding would have a view on this. And then we can talk also, what's your own personal opinion? Because I think we have some differences of opinion here. I'm not going to force anybody to come out and tell you what they think. But if they want to, Jake included, I know he will be happy to share his own opinion. And I'll be happy to share mine. So maybe
Let me just qualify something real quick. When we do the Hanover House, since I don't know how to drink coffee, according to most everybody in this group. I prefer to think of the Hanover House more as like the tent meetings. We just wing it here. So that's how I like to think about it.
Cody, they serve just cups of milk at your coffee shop, right?
Yeah, sadly.
So there's a drink there for Jake.
Yeah, I mean, if he wants to get a chocolate milk with all the other, you know, 5 and 6 year old girls, then he's welcome to. So,
well, I just always remember that it was said the land of Canaan flowed with milk and honey, not with coffee. So I stand more biblical than any of y'all. So if we want to go down that trail,
Jake, I'll tell you this: an hour away from where you are, you live in Louisville. Go over to Lexington. What is it? Coffee Times, I think it is. They've got like a frozen hot chocolate that's delicious.
That sounds good.
If you're just not in the mood for that, I like that. Just call it what it is, and there's no shame in drinking a frozen hot chocolate. It's not coffee. Anyway, Connor, welcome to the show. Connor is pastor up in Michigan, and Jonathan, I guess, or John. I guess I should have, you put Jonathan in here, so I'm going to call you Jonathan. But you guys are at the same church, so Connor's the pastor there, senior pastor there, right? Is that your title?
Well, I'm at the church. Well,
I know. Now I've got to couch everything I say. My pastor's here. All right, watch out.
No, John's doing a lot of he's doing school work down there in Nash, Vegas. So he's not able to be physically present, but we go to the same church.
That's
great.
Awesome.
When he's here.
So
we miss him.
Connor, and I guess everybody who's listening, goal for right now, I want to talk, I guess, first historical views on how to think through this issue of who should be allowed to come to the table. And I don't know if Jesse or Jake wants to give maybe, let's think early Baptists, and then does that opinion on that morph over time to where we're at today? And then Jonathan, I'd love after that, if you can give me a little bit more lay of the land on just the Reformation understanding purely, irrespective of Baptistic life. So Jesse, Jake, one of you guys want to take that historical question and help me understand all that's going on there?
I'll let Jake speak for the particular Baptist. Typically, the general Baptist practiced closed or close communion, so requiring that a person be baptized by immersion to partake of the supper. And that's a pretty standard view. There's not a lot of debate about that. I think Jake can maybe address this some. I think among the particular Baptists, there's maybe a bit of debate in the 17th century, but the general Baptist pretty much held close communion or even closed communion sort of across the board, and that's pretty consistent. Some might say that's because of their sectarian views on maybe some things, but yeah, it's pretty consistent there. I was listening to your episode from just a few days ago, I guess, on Spurgeon. So I guess by the time you get into the 19th century, things have changed quite a bit. My guess would be a lot has changed even by the 18th century on this in some circles. But yeah, for me, just addressing the issue of the general Baptist, close communion is pretty much the norm.
Yeah, so when we're talking about the particular Baptist, the majority of those men in churches in the 17th century would have been very similar. They would have held to close or closed. But there was always a strong minority that held to open communion. And that goes to the early days when we're talking about in the 1640s when these churches are first, you know, organizing and forming. Henry Jesse, who was a very prominent leader during that time, was an open communion advocate. And so there was always a stream in that part of Baptist life. Now, what's fascinating was when the first London Baptist Confession was written, there was nothing in there said about, you know, who could come to the table. When they did a revision of it in 1646, and Benjamin Cox, Nehemiah Cox's father, answered some charges, they actually inserted a statement there about that only those who had been baptized could come to the table. Now, when the second London Baptist Confession is written, written in 1677, that's when it's published first, and then, you know, the General Assembly in 1689 will endorse it. There's nothing in the Second London that says who can come to the table. And in the appendix towards the end of that they write on baptism, they talk about how there was a difference of opinion among them in their association. But they didn't want to make that an association fellowship issue. Now, the strong majority were close communion. probably one of the most, I don't know if intense would be the right word, but it was a very, intense would be the right word. Debates in early, particular Baptist life was between John Bunyan, who took an open communion view, but also Bunyan was open membership, which is why, some of us would question whether he's even really should be classified as a Baptist or not. And then William Kiffin, writes in response in 1681, pushing back against Bunyan's view. So it's very fascinating that the majority were close. There was, though, always an element of open. Now, going on with what Jesse said, Dr. Changen talking about with Spurgeon in his day, a friend of mine on Twitter commented, Ben Stratton, that I would agree with him, some of his observations. Sometimes this gets thrown as, over here in America, it was just the landmarkers who were just dominant, and everybody changed over in Britain. But the change in Britain among particular Baptists really doesn't happen until the early 19th century due to the influence of Robert Hall Jr. But you still had very much your prominent Baptist theologians among the particular Baptists, John Gill, Andrew Fuller, and Abraham Booth, all were advocates of what we would call close or strict communion. And I would agree with Ben's observation that the reason that in America it goes longer with being close communion is not really the landmark movement, because there were non-landmark Southern Baptists and Northern Baptists who were vehemently opposed to open communion. John Dagg, R.B.C. Howell were Southern Baptists who were not landmarkers. They battled against J.R. Graves, but they were against open communion, and Francis Whalen in the North was opposed to it as well. And that's because in America, Andrew Fuller and John Gill were the most influential British particular Baptist ministers. Robert Hall Jr. was not very influential here at all. He isn't in Britain. He was a great orator, but his influence is not really here in America. So that would be one reason why it stays longer over here. And of course, the landmark movement does have some impact with that in the South.
Garrett, I know you've been doing a lot of research on John Ryland or whatnot. Do you have anything to add in comparison to Jake, besides if you want to be more sophisticated and call them Baptistic Congregationalists?
I haven't read Dr. Bingham's book, Orthodox Radicals, so I don't think I can use the term.
Is it because you can't afford, like me, you can't afford the book yet? Is that what it is?
I can't afford it yet. I'm hoping enough rich people buy it and it'll be released as a paperback for me. So in the 18th century, yeah, there's, Jake mentioned the Kiffin Bunyan debate. In the 18th century, it kind of revives again. John Collett Ryland is someone I've been doing some research on, and he is, he started off as a strict communion person at his church in Warwick. And, a few years into his pastorate there, he becomes, open communion. And ends up leaving the church, probably because of that, and takes the church at Northampton. He authors a work, A Modest Plea for Open Communion, and it gets picked up by a guy named Daniel Turner and gets some pretty broad circulation. They kind of circulated under a pseudonym. And so it's interesting, the debate that kind of reemerges in the last quarter century of the 18th century. So it kind of ebbs and flows in Baptist life. I do think the vast majority of particular Baptist churches, at least, were a kind of closed communion. Another term you see in the literature is strict communion. Another term is restricted communion. So you kind of see how that kind of ebbs and flows. But I don't think open communion really gains a majority for quite some time.
I do want to get Jonathan on broader Reformation thinking on this topic. Is there distinctive viewpoints from other, segments of Protestantism on the topic?
Yeah. So sorry if I cut out. I don't know what's going on. I've got a little bit of internet instability. I'm currently on the road, as Connor mentioned, living a peripatetic lifestyle between Nashville and then up north. So if it cuts out, I'll come back on. But it's a great setup for the Baptist conversation. Is a great setup for kind of what comes before. You've got kind of a spectrum of belief, of course, and the 100, 150 years before the particular Baptists kind of come onto the the religious stage there. And to kind of take a step back, what we have kind of at root here is this attempt to approximate the invisible church with the visible church. So you've got really a fight over and among the Swiss, the Germans, and the French over how one goes about that. And the problem you run into in the earlier period is this, the state church. And even in England before 1640, before kind of the recognition of the dissenting churches and the rise of the particular Baptists, you've got with the royal supremacy, this kind of body politic is commensurate with the visible church, which is supposed to be commensurate with the invisible church. And so that really causes a lot of tension in England and even before that and on the continent. And you've have them wrestle with that in different ways. And so the Lutherans kind of start early on with this process of preparation and examination, and that's kind of spearheaded by the minister. Luther even writes a sermon on it in 1518, I believe, to his congregation to help them prepare for the Lord's Supper. Because in doing that, you're able to kind of, in some sense, weed out the unworthy, according to Paul's prescription in 1 Corinthians 11. And so you've got this self-censoring that's supposed to go on, led by the minister. And that pattern is repeated in Switzerland and in France. It's unclear whether there's a direct kind of chronological connection between the three. Certainly the three areas, there's certainly this reciprocal relationship with the writing letters back and forth about how to deal with these issues over the course of the 16th century into the 17th. But nevertheless, this similar attempt to kind of provide for the self-censoring of the folks that would come to the communion table early on by preparing themselves and deciding whether or not they're one, converted. And if so, if they've been in some kind of grave error or sin that might cast some kind of shadow or aspersion on their profession of faith. So that's kind of around the world way to come back to the question of the Baptists. They've come out of all of these conversations that are going on, and they're what they end up going with, and the close, open, or close communion, the churches kind of take different positions. And for a while there's no, among particular Baptists especially, there's no, as Jacob mentioned, there's no quite kind of orthodox position, as it were. So I don't know if that helps or muddies the waters, but all that to say, it's quite complicated early on, and you see a variety of iterations of what would come later in these early churches on the continent and in England.
Excellent. So I do want to take a pause for our audience. If you have thoughts or questions, go ahead, kick them over to us now on this historical little survey, because I do want to jump in to the practical aspect of what's your viewpoint? Why do you think one is correct over the other? So we've got our first segment here. So I'll give you 60 seconds to type me a question. And if you don't type one, then I'm going to go on. So while you're typing a question, if you are, before we jump in, Jake, this seems like an appropriate time for you to give us a nice little segue with your tremendous communion story. Before we jump into the topic at hand, which I think was introduced to me by either Jesse or Sam Renahan. I'm not sure who it was who brought it up, but this needs to be out in the air. So tell us this great communion story.
So anticipated.
And then if you have a question, audience, whoever's listening, watching, we'll get to it after Jake's done.
Well, number one, let me say nobody asked me any questions about this story after I get finished with it, so we'll leave it there. I want to say, first of all, that I'm very thankful for being raised in the church, being raised in a Baptist church, and even many times I'm thankful that I was reared in a landmark context. Although I would, depart from where some of that is, what it taught, I'm thankful for the grounding it gave me. And I also want to say that as the years pass, I realize more and more that I don't know as much as I think I know. And so time humbles us all, and the Lord continues to humble and teach. Having said all that, I used to think I had the answers to a lot of things, and I don't. I find that I have fewer answers these days. Having said all of that, when I was growing up, we were in a landmark background. But we were in a kind of a even very smaller landmark group, we'll put it that way. So we had our own traditions that others didn't have. So we only did communion once a year. And usually it was where I grew up at was on the Wednesday before Easter. First church I pastored, we did it the Saturday before Easter. One of the reasons we did that was so we wouldn't have any visitors show up, because we didn't want to have to be confrontational and tell them they couldn't participate since they weren't members. You know, we were a landmark Baptist, but we didn't want to be, you know, hateful about it and tell them, you know, you can't join us. So we did it when most people don't show up, especially on a Saturday. So growing up, when we went, we didn't talk to each other. You know, we got in the vehicle silence to the church silence. You know, we didn't talk to each other. We took our places. Service did it. Silence. Leave. Silence. Vehicle. Go home. Silence. Then we talked. Now, I always noticed this. So it's like, it was very much like going to a funeral. It was, you know, it was, the emphasis was on reverence and being somber. But as you can tell, kind of to an extreme, you know, it was like you were going to the funeral home. And I always noticed that the pastors and the deacons stayed behind, while the rest of us filed out, left, went home. Of course, then when I became a pastor in that group and began at my first church, I learned why they stayed behind. Because it was taught that the leftover elements, the unleavened bread, and I'm sure your audience will be shocked to hear that we did not use fermented wine, but we used Welch's grape juice, as Jesus used in John 2 at the wedding at Cana. That's what we were taught, and I preached that back in the day too, unfortunately. So we were taught that whatever was left over was to be buried behind the church to represent the burial of Christ. So there I am as a 20-year-old for my first communion service. I had been instructed in this, so I came to the church with a shovel from home. We did the service, and I had two deacons at that church, and where we were, I mean, if you want a visual of a rural country Southern Baptist church, we were it. White cinder block, cemetery next to us. There I am in my white shirt, my suit, my tie, took my coat off, left it in this building. We made our way to the back outside, where we were going to bury the elements. Now, if any of you have ever done communion, if you're a minister, you've seen it, you usually know that there's like a little canister. You get the big Welch's bottle, because that's what we're supposed to use. And you would take that and you'd pour it then into a little canister, and then you'd, you know, squirt it into the little cups, and that's how you distribute. Well, I like Welch's grape juice. I actually think it tastes good. So my, you know, and I had went, you know, I had bought that. So I was going to, you know, what we had left, I was going to, you know, take home. I was just going to pour what was in that little canister, what was left in it, into the ground. So here we go. Us three make our way. I roll my sleeves up, my shirt, sleeves up. And there I do, begin to dig. I thought years later, people might have passed by and wondered where, you know, we were trying to dig up some grave out there, body snatchers or something. And I put the unleavened bread we had left down at the, you know, the bottom. And then I poured the little canister, and I thought we were done for the evening. And, you know, by this time in Mississippi, it's hot, so I'm sweating like I don't know what. I'm ready to get back in the AC. And I had a deacon say, "Oh, no, Brother Jake, we got to give it all to the Lord." So there I was with that big old Welch's container and just dumped that whole thing into the ground and then cover the hole up. And no, I didn't go then the next day, Easter Sunday, and go dig it up to represent the resurrection of Christ. I share all this to say the Lord is merciful and gracious to us. He has been to me in many ways.
I know if you're listening to this after the fact, I have been crying. So it's funny the first time, but like the second time you hear it, it's just, I don't know what to say.
That was the third or fourth time for me. And I think it was even funnier that time.
If the Lord blesses me to ever teach Baptist history in a classroom, I hope that'll be one thing all the students remember about taking me, is to hear that story. So,
and I like seeing other people's reactions to it. If you're watching this live Hanover House, you can see the faces, I think. But that was rich, seeing you guys react to Brother Jake's wonderful story.
Yeah, something like that. So with that in view, I didn't get any questions. So whoever's watching or listening, you need to save your questions.
Well, thank goodness. I'm glad nobody asked any more questions about that. So
now, that said, I want to get into, I guess, the more practical aspect of what's your own theological opinion on these sort of things. So I guess I can go first, and then people can just critique me if they want and tell me you haven't thought about this enough, and maybe I haven't. So in my peon little brain, the way I've thought about this, and I think before I share my own theological opinion on it, I wanted to make a distinction that I think is helpful, at least in my mind, between the regular practice of the Lord's table, if someone's at regularly every single week they're partaking of it, versus I'm there for a special occasion. I came to visit my family, so I'm visiting this church. So the way I think about it is I would be open communion for those irregular sort of visits. So if someone is a family member, say, you know, one of my cousins, they're Presbyterians. I guess my uncle was baptized as a believer, but my cousin was not. Now, if he came and visited me, came to church with me, I know he's a believer, I'd be fine open communion for that one Sunday, or two Sundays if they're there for 2 weeks, sort of thing. However, I think when it comes to regular practice of communion, if you're there every single week, I'd be more closed communion, where I don't care if you've been baptized by immersion. I think you need to be a member of this church to regularly partake of the table with us. Because to me, the reason I take those two positions, the reason I say open for someone who's irregularly there, is because to me, the way the table is a covenant meal saying, I affirm you as a believer. So if I deny you the table, I'm essentially saying you're not a believer. And I don't want to say that. And maybe there's a way to circumvent that worry. Now, the reason I'd be okay going closed on a regular basis for someone who's regularly there is because I think if you're regularly a part of this church and not a member, there's something weird going on here that we need to address. So that's my two cents. You guys can tell me that I'm wrong or I'm crazy off the reservation, or maybe tell me that no one has thought that in the history of the church to have a two-tiered system. I don't know. I'm not a Baptist historian like all you guys, so you guys got to tell me where I'm. I took Baptist history with Dr. Nettles, Tom Nettles, so I mean, I should know something, but not as much as you guys. So tell me what's going on here.
One thing I'd just say historically to kind of frame the conversation, when talking about open communion, particularly now, even among Baptists, I think in some ways it's more helpful to think of kind of four nodes: closed, closer, close, open. Because some would say, including some Protestant liberals, that open would be all people, including some might say people of all faith. And that actually has even an historical root in England. And I mean, I'm thinking particularly helpful. In the 1640s, there was debate over whether or not the Lord's Supper was a converting ordinance. And that was even among kind of an odd wing of the Puritan Party, and there was a big kind of polemical tract debate, and they went back and forth over whether or not they should be admitting people into to communion that weren't known to be converted. So all of that to say, and under the framework I just kind of set out, I think I would kind of follow you in some ways, but I would land more on the closer, probably on the close side, where those known to be believers and made a profession of faith. Those I would admit to communion. The caveat being, though, that I would always, if I needed to err on one side, it would always be the closed side, all the way back to kind of the local congregation. And again, going back to the pastor's charge to care for this group, this local body of believers, and to shepherd their souls to eternity, there is, in some sense, a duty incumbent on the pastor to ensure that they're not communicating unworthily and that they're not admitting non-believers to the sacrament. And so a pastor can have kind of a, a greater or lesser sense of somebody who's there as a visitor or somebody who's there irregularly, you know, where they kind of stand.
Yeah, I mean, sorry, Garrett, or whoever was about, I think you're Garrett, you're about to talk. I'll let you talk in a second. Just a thought that came to my mind, something that's always messed with my brain a little bit and my own theological thinking on this is, you know, the very first, I guess, communion service with Jesus and the disciples, seems that Jesus willingly gives the cup and the bread to Judas, which always seems like confusing. So maybe somebody wants to explain that and answer how that works into our frameworks here. Because I think a lot of people who want to advocate, just give it to anybody indiscriminately, don't ask questions, would look to something like that and say, well, look, Jesus gives it to Judas and he knew he wasn't a believer. So how does that, I guess, play into this?
This may be a little bit simplistic, but that particular act of giving of the bread and the cup to Judas is a particular fulfillment of scripture. Maybe it's just as simple as that. I don't know if I would make some kind of prescriptive point from that. So one question I want to come back to, Jordan. I don't intend this as kind of provocative toward you. I want to know, is it necessarily the case that denying someone to the table is denying their Christian profession? I think that is a really important feature of this conversation, because if it is, I think my opinion would probably be different. If saying you cannot come to the supper at my church means I don't believe you're truly converted, then I think that really changes the terms of the conversation. So for instance, I mean, there's a lot of discussion about Catholicity. And so if we have that view of the supper, there's no sense in which Baptists could truly be small C Catholic, because we would say only immersion, only baptized by immersion converts are truly in the church and can partake worthily of the supper. And that blocks out not only a large number of people currently, but think about for 2,000 years. So I think we would have to say that admitting and denying people from the supper does not necessarily mean that we're denying their Christian testimony of conversion. So I think if you were to remove that element from this, I think it changes a good bit. So I'm interested, is that necessarily the case? Every time I have advocated a more restricted view, that's always been the pushback. I think that's almost like intuitive or instinctual that, oh, to disallow someone from the supper means you're denying their Christian conversion. Well, that's not true in the case of church discipline. When we censure someone from the supper, we're not saying we don't believe you're converted. There are other kinds of kind of intermediary statements that are being made with someone censured from the supper for some reason.
I think you're putting your finger on an important issue. I do struggle to think about, like, so if we're talking about, you know, excommunication and church discipline, it seems that excommunication, taking the table away from them, is like that you are being treated as a Gentile or a non-believer, as I think Matthew 18 would suggest. So it seems to me that the table is a marker of whether you're a believer or not.
I think I would take it more like Paul confronting Peter in the book of Galatians. I saw this conduct was out of step with the gospel, so I opposed him to his face. I think that's how I view the disciplinary censure from the table. Excommunication, I think, is that statement of, at least in some situations, we've lost confidence in your Christian conversion. Censuring from the table is there's something significant, something significantly out of step with the gospel in your life, and we're calling you to repentance so that we could restore you to table fellowship. I think I view the censuring as kind of an intermediary step between full fellowship and excommunication. But anyway, I'm interested in that. I think the church discipline piece is a big deal in our understanding of the supper. and it impacts who we would allow or disallow to come. If the supper is a means or a tool of church discipline, then I think church membership status has a big part to play in the discussion.
Yeah, I mean, so from a practical perspective, I mean, I think one of the things I would want to ask related to what y'all are discussing is, if we don't take the open communion approach and we do something like close, and so we don't permit, let's say, a paedo-baptist to the table, I think that the question that we need to answer is, what are we saying? Or why are we borrowing them from the table?
Because to me, it's totally weird. You know, Mark Dever has Ligon Duncan. Well, I guess Ligon Duncan's an exception because Ligon was baptized as a believer. But let's say Mark could have a paedo-baptist come and preach at his church, and he'd have no problem with that. But then he would tell them, you cannot take of the table. Now, that seems really radical and odd to me to say you can come preach, you could deliver the word, but you cannot partake of the sacrament after the fact. Like, what's going on here? That seems like a huge disconnect.
Yeah, Garrett, would you say that the issue of baptism in particular and the right administration of it, would you say that is that kind of Galatian scenario where you're not questioning somebody's salvation, but you're saying to your paedo-baptist brother, hey, I believe that because you've not rightly entered the sacrament, right, that like you're walking out of step with the gospel in some way, shape, or form. Not in any sort of like disciplinable way, but like would you say that's kind of in line with what you've been saying in regards to like a close view in particular?
I don't think so. I don't think I would say that a paedo-baptist is out of step with the gospel in like the Peter Galatians 2 kind of way. I think I would make the distinction like we would make in ecclesiology about there's rightly ordered churches, there's irregular churches, and then there's false churches. So I would say my paedo-baptist brothers are irregular in their attention to the ordinance of baptism. And the supper, I think, is one of those more frequent than a year. One of those frequent points of contact where you examine if your life is rightly ordered according to God's design. And so there are some good arguments for why baptism precedes the Lord's Supper. Here's just one. I'll let you guess from what confession of faith this comes from. It says, it talks about Christian baptism. It says, it's a testimony to his faith in the final resurrection of the dead. Being a church ordinance, it is prerequisite to the privileges of church membership and to the Lord's Supper. Anyone want to take a stab at what horribly restrictive and narrow-minded Baptist confession says that?
I want to take a guess. I think it's the BFM 2000.
It is, yeah. All of you Southern Baptists out there, your own Baptist faith and message takes this strict Baptist view. And so I think there's something to that. I mean, I know some of our 1689 friends sometimes even joke about the Baptist faith and message being sometimes not as stringent or precise as they might like it to be. But at least on this, it takes a very strict view. I think we should think about that.
Hey, before Jake gets too excited over here, he's like, I can't even believe he's been this patient. Because I know we're going to go away from open and he's going to, you know, just explain it to us all. But I just want to know, maybe Jordan can help us. If you were to do, let's say, open communion, how do you, if you want to fence the table in some meaningful way, let's say you have a Presbyterian present, you're willing to admit them to the table. But how do you fence the table in a meaningful way? Is it a conversation beforehand? Is it just in, you know, some pronouncement you give before the supper? Do you go Spurgeon and start handing out those tickets, or, you know, how do you do it?
I mean, Jesse, just think about your average church. I bet your average church, the fencing of the table is the pastor or whoever explaining this is for believers only, and that's the extent of the fencing. I mean, honestly, I don't think I've ever been to a church that did more.
Yeah, and Jordan, maybe you make it sound more simple than I mentally make it, because I've been at my church for 2 years, and I inherited the open communion, and I have some convictions about that, but I feel like I fumble it every time. Like I say stuff like, this is a covenant meal for new covenant members, and if that means you've trusted in Christ and Christ alone for your salvation, and you have the accountability of a local church, and there's nothing going on in your life that's, you know, a serious unrepentant. And I just fumble. I totally botch it because I want to be so clear and so protective of what this meal represents. And I actually want to, I don't know if this is going back, but I want to ask the question to kind of even help me think through it, because I'm probably going to change my mind on this issue 3 or 4 times before I'm dead. So I asked the question, what do the sacraments indicate? You know, what do they symbolize? You say, okay, baptism is our sign and seal, our entrance into the new covenant community, the physical reminder of that and representation of that. And then that's the initiating sign, right? And then the Lord's Supper is the ongoing sign. And who tells me that I have entered the new covenant?
Yeah, Connor, that's a great
local
question.
A local church. And then so who tells me that I can continue on? Who has the authority to say that I can enter and continue receiving the signs, receiving the sacraments? And so the answer to both is the local church. And so the question I'm going to just throw out there, and then somebody can answer, is if I don't have the authority to tell you that you cannot receive the supper, do I have the authority to tell you that you can?
Yeah, if I could just take a stab at that, Connor. I'm similar to you. I'm a pastor of a great church, and I have inherited an open communion practice as well. And my personal conscience is more restrictive than that. I fence the supper almost every week at our church. We take the supper every week. And when I arrived, we would say, this meal is for baptized believers who are in right standing with your local church. Doesn't have to be this one. A church that preaches the same gospel that we preach. If you're a baptized believer in right standing. So we've emphasized baptism. We've emphasized membership of a church, and obviously a converted believer. And so when we say a member in good standing, we mean not under church discipline. And I think church discipline, that wielding of the keys of the kingdom, is the way that the congregation binds and looses. And so the reason someone might not come to the supper shouldn't necessarily be I sinned this week. I thought a certain way this week, and therefore I'm unworthy to come. Or I looked at something I shouldn't have looked at this week, therefore I'm unworthy to come. We try to emphasize that the Lord's Supper is a sacrament. It's a means of grace where Christ is spiritually present, communing with us, administering grace to us. And that spiritual presence view, what we're saying is, it's not if you've sinned this week, you shouldn't come. It's if you sin this week, you especially need to come. And so we try to emphasize that. And so when I got there, we were fencing the table this way, baptized believer in good standing with your church. And I was saying, this is great. This is awesome. But we regularly had people in our congregation who were paedo-baptists, who were not credo-baptized. So I brought this up at an officers meeting, or at least to the elders, and mentioned this. I was like, hey, you know, we're saying baptized, but it sounds like we don't really mean baptized by immersion. And so they basically said, yeah, what we mean is if you've been baptized according to what your conscience approves as what baptism is. So a Presbyterian sitting in our congregation believes that he's been baptized, and we leave the what baptism is to their conscience. So we fence the table in a closed way or a close way, and leave it to their conscience to decide whether or not they should take it or not. I kind of gave a little pushback on that. And so what we ended up doing, we removed the word baptized from the way we fenced the table, which was not the effect I was going for. it was polar opposite of what I was shooting for. So now we just say, if you are a believer in right standing with your church, because what we didn't want to do was have two definitions of baptism, a definition of baptism from the confession, the 1689 confession our church holds, that says baptism is immersion, but then a weekly verbal functional definition that says something that you do with water, whatever you think it is. So we modified toward an open view, which again was not what I was shooting for, but at least we're clear now.
Jake, are you ready to release?
Yeah,
release?
That's
Connor, you got something?
No,
to add.
I was just gonna say that's helpful. No, I was just gonna say that's helpful from what Garrett said. He and I will have to chat after because I have more questions, but it's irrelevant. And I do want to hear what Brother Jake has to say.
For sure. Well, I'll pipe in for a second first. I by the way, side note, I always find it really funny that Luke Duncan is always the example of what people use in regards to like allowing a paedo Baptist to the table. Like my pastor does it all the time. He's like, well, I'm going to be feasting with Lig in glory. So why can't I feast with him now? You know? But.
And of course he was baptized as a believer.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And that, I mean, that makes it complicated.
Fun facts.
but anyway, one thing that I always think about, and this is me being an OT guy. So Exodus 12 and Passover, right? So some, sacrament, if you will, that is typifying to some degree the supper or what we're kind of what symbolized there. So the language of Exodus 12 is interesting because it says, you know, no foreigner shall eat of it. But if you have, you know, in a sense, some form of an outsider or a hired worker among you, if they enter into the community through circumcision, right, then they can participate in Passover with your family, right? So if they enter into the community properly, then they can partake of this meal with you each year that you take it. And that's something that sticks with me as I think about the supper is this idea that I feel like the biblical expectation is that you have properly entered into the community. And if you haven't properly entered into the community, aka if you've not been baptized as a believer, right, whatever form that may come, right, immersion, whatever, like if you've not been brought into the community as a believer, right, properly, then what does that say about whether I, yeah, allow? Let's say, yeah, your run-of-the-mill paedo Baptist, not Lig Duncan, who was baptized as a believer, but like your kind of like run-of-the-mill paedo Baptist. What does that say about that? That's something that, and I don't know if I have a good answer to that, but that's kind of like that kind of biblical, I would say, push almost, at least on my end. That's something that just sticks with me as I've thought through this question over the years.
All right, Jake, hit us with the hammer.
Well, let me start off by saying that it is interesting to note how the American Baptist Confessions of Faith all are strict communion. The New Hampshire Confession is that way. I pulled out to make sure I would be correct here, and from the Abstract of Principles, which governs the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, on Article 15 on baptism, the last sentence, it is a prerequisite to church fellowship and to participation in the Lord's Supper. And the BFM, all of that's drawing from that heritage. This is why we should actually know what our confessions say and subscribe to them, as opposed to what usually happens in Baptist life these days. You know, I listened to all this, and I respect. So let me first of all say, I would never make this an associational issue, which is one reason I personally, if we're speaking about how an association governs churches, I do think the 1689 gets it right as not making that a confessional subscription issue. All right. So I, personally, I like the strict communion language, but I would not make that a associational fellowship issue. Now,
can I chime in on that, Jake?
Sure. Yeah.
I totally agree. Yeah. So the 1689 is basically agnostic on this issue. And for that reason, I'm fine being in a confessional church administering this in an open way. So that's what we've covenanted together to do. And so I don't feel like I'm violating my conscience by administering this in an open way. That was the collective will of the church led by the elders before I got there. And so I'm part of it. And so, you know, one day I'd love to teach on this and, you know, some slow change in a more restrictive way, maybe. But for me, it's not something I would divide over, nor do I feel like I'm sinning and administering it in a more broad way than I prefer. So for me, I'm trying to preserve the unity of the church by specifically saying our confession, I don't want to be more strict than our confession is on some of these kinds of things.
Yeah, I want to make something very clear. I am not by any means wanting to give the impression that I think that to be close or closed is to be more faithful to the 1689 than to be open. I do think to be close is to be more of a Baptist than to be open. I do think that. But I'm not going to say that on the confessional part. Here's the thing. There is nobody in the history of the church, as I am aware of, as we're talking about here, Protestants, you know, all stripes here, everybody has believed that baptism is a prerequisite for communion. That is not a Baptist invention. You know, Baptists didn't invent that. What we say is baptism actually means what the scriptures teach, that it is for a believer who is immersed in the name of the triune God. Now, what happens a lot of times, and Jordan, all of your points that you raised about if you let a paedo-baptist person preach and all that, I want you to know that John Dagg answers 9 objections in his treatise on church order, including those. So he was smarter than I was. And by the way, that's Mark Dever's hero in Baptist polity is John Dagg. And so I would just encourage people, go read those things.
You know, it's funny you say that. Maybe I'll give it away now. I've got an extra copy because I bought 2 of them, and I'm going to give one away to listeners.
I think it's an excellent work on Baptist polity. That first of all, it's, you know, John, if I can do a side note here, John Dagg's work on his systematic theology was the first systematic theology ever published by a Southern Baptist. And his treatise on church order is excellent. And Garrett is holding up John Dagg. Now, I know he does not look like a very friendly guy, but he is a Baptist hero and a stalwart.
He's got that Jake Stone solemn face there, doesn't he?
Oh, no, I smile more than John Dagg. You know, I do smile.
Hey, can I double down on one of your points, Jake?
Sure.
Let me read you this from Abraham Booth.
Yes.
This is from Peter Naylor's book, which I highly recommend, Calvinism, Communion, and the Baptists, a study of English Calvinistic Baptists from the late 1600s to the early 1800s. Stellar book. He says that Abraham Booth, 1734 to 1806, asserted boldly that Baptists who were not strict Baptists were not, strictly speaking, Baptists. The congregation... And he goes on and talks about Booth's church. And so Booth saw this as like the strict view is like the most consistently Baptist thing to do.
Yeah. Here's what it gets at. William Kiffin said this in his work, Pushing Against John Bunyan. He said, I have no other design but the preserving the ordinances of Christ in their purity and order as they are left unto us in the Holy Scriptures of truth, and to warn the churches to keep close to the rule, lest they being found not to worship the Lord according to his prescribed order, he make a breach among them. Now, I know that we can get emotional and we don't want to be called sectarian, but as Baptists, we just need to own it because we've been being called sectarian for 400 years. So that's not going away. So either we're going to be Baptist or we're not going to be Baptist. You know, Andrew Fuller in his day, I've got all these things pulled up. We could read all this stuff all night. I don't want to go for 3 hours here and somebody end up being
just
Eutychus.
Join the Kiffin room. You can go on for 3 hours.
Well, we can't. Well, yeah, you could, but, you know. I don't know if everybody can't travel to Louisville
nice
for
plug.
That.
The nice president plug. And founder of the Kiffin Room right here, Jake.
Thank you. So Fuller said here, to me, it appears evident that paedobaptism opened the door for the Romish apostasy and that the church will never be restored to its purity while it is allowed to have any existence in it. The grand cause of the church's having been corrupted so as to become apostate was its being, and then he has in all caps, mingled with the world. Paedobaptism first occasioned this fatal mixture, and national establishments of religion completed it. And I think that when we're talking about who can come to the table, I'm not advocating that we have somebody standing there and they're ready to, you know, swat somebody's hand that's going forth that we don't think, you know, should get it. But I do think that our Baptist forebears thought it was important to get right. Getting worship, we've got to get right. How we do church, we've got to get right. And I know it was said earlier about, you know, if I'm going to dine with Lig at the table, you know, in heaven and all that. Well, that's one of the things that Dag raised. He said, yeah, we believe that there's people from everywhere who come to Christ's banquet table and are saved. But this is a church ordinance. This is something the church does. You know, that's part of the problem. I love George Whitefield. Thank God used him greatly. But he was having communion out there in the fields, you know, and everybody just come on. Us having communion at weddings and all these things, we have so gotten away from what Scripture teaches about it that when anybody says, well, this ain't just open for everybody, then, you know, all of a sudden I want to get offended by that. And, you know, Abraham Booth, William Kiffin, all those men, it's like, well, we're not trying to be mean. We're not trying to hurt people's feelings. We believe this is what Scripture teaches. And if all of us in Christianity have believed that baptism is a prerequisite for the table, then the question is, what is baptism? And if we're going to say that really doesn't matter, then the question is, why are we Baptists? Which is why Bunyan was consistent. I'll give him that. A consistent view is open membership in some ways with open communion. And, you know, I love Spurgeon. I thank God for him. I think he was wrong on this issue. You know, personally, I love the little ticket idea, but that's not regulative principle. So I can't go along with that. But that's what happens when you go with open communion. You've already moved away from the regulative principle in some ways. So that's Fuller's point. Once you start down the trail a little bit, you know, that's how we get in trouble. So I think that if we're going to be consistent Baptist, I think that we should hold to a close communion. Now, when I pastored, I struggled with fencing too. How do I word it? How do I say it? I think sometimes we never did this, but I thought, you know, putting something in the bulletin, if somebody was visiting and they weren't sure, come talk to us afterwards. I think that we need to separate what is Christian fellowship and what is church fellowship. And I think that communion, the Lord's Supper, the ordinances, that's a church fellowship issue. None of us would say that we recognize, at least, you know, I think we all agree on this, that we would recognize sprinkling as baptism. That's why I really don't like using the term infant baptism, because it's not baptism. Sprinkling. These terms mean something. And so I know that we want to be Catholic and we want to be friendly, and I agree with all those things, but that doesn't mean we stop being Baptist. And
this is a free podcast. So. This is a free.
Hey, I was commended for being patient. I was patient, and I, you know, and I, you know,
patient.
I love everybody that is in
two P's.
I feel like I've been sitting in a tent meeting right now, man. I'm feeling pumped up.
I'm sweating for you, Jake.
I'm gonna go run through the aisles.
Well, thankfully that I am glad that we did. We did not do communion at the tent revival I preached. So we did a lot of stuff wrong in that meeting, but we didn't do that, thankfully.
So, Jake, so. I would like to maybe ask it this way. When we talk about theological triage, sometimes Moeller's famous article and one of the Ortland's great books, Finding the Right Hills to Die On, talk about like kind of first order doctrines, second order doctrines, and third order doctrines. Would you say this is a second order doctrine for you, or third? Because I don't know. Sometimes those categories are helpful. I guess if I were to try to define those, third order doctrine, we could have disagreement among the about this and be within the same church, which is, I think, what I've been trying to say. So, like, I'm in a church where our practice is more open, and I think some of our church members are probably more restrictive and some are more open about this, but our church practice is open. So I guess we're treating it like a third order issue. However, it does seem to get at something ecclesiologically that I would want to say is a second order issue. So I feel like I would talk about it like a second order issue, but I would practice it as a third order issue, which might just be inconsistent of me.
Yeah. So let's just kind of roll the dice here for a minute, and let's think about it for a second. So, you know, Connor, he's already confessed that he does open communion there where he pastors. Okay. So, but he is doing a lot of good things where he serves at. I don't think if I were in that area, I don't think I would say, you know what, they do open communion there. I can't join that church. You know, I don't think that I would land there. I mean, if my choice is obviously a Baptist church that is seeking to follow Scripture, you know, ordinary means of grace, moving in a confessional direction, you know, he's got something here that, you know, I don't agree with necessarily, but I mean, where am I going to go? Where else am I going to go? To some, you know, a Reformed Paedo-Baptist church? I'm not going to go there because I don't think they're not doing baptism right. They don't practice baptism mostly correctly. So why would I go there? So I would be hesitant to put it to that level where I would say I can't join that church. Now, if the choice is between, you know, put it this way, let's say that there's an open communion 1689 church in the neighborhood, or a close 1689 church does close communion, I'd probably land at the close communion, you know. Now, there could be a whole host of other factors. The pastor there may be a jerk. I don't know. So why would I wouldn't go there if that's the case. But I do think here's where we get in trouble. We get in trouble because ecclesiology does not justify. So I don't want anybody to hear me thinking that I'm still, you know, a Baptist brider and, you know, I'm on the old paths in that way. However, it does matter. We used to think ecclesiology represented the gospel, actually. That's what Baptists used to believe. That's why it was so important. And I think we're so scared of sounding too tribal that we kind of shrink back from what might be considered unattractive elements. The case is Andrew Fuller would not have served communion to Lig Duncan. Or if we can go back to that point, you know, he wouldn't have served John Newton. He wouldn't.
Or John.
Now, does that mean that he didn't love John Newton or think John Newton was not a brother in Christ? Of course not. He believed John Newton was a man of God and a fellow Christian. But that's how they understood. This was, you have to get polity right and worship right. All those things were intertwined. And that's why when we talk about the regulative principle, it's not just on worship. It is on all of our views of ecclesiology. And we need it. We sorely need it. If people can disagree with me, and that's fine. I hope one thing that can be brought out of this is, as Baptists, we need to start really looking at ourselves and asking, how did we get in the mess we're in 2021 when it comes to how we do church and stuff? Whether we're looking at what's happening in, you know, SBC world or wherever else, how did we get here? And it's because we stopped actually believing the gospel transforms the church and polity and how we do things. And we started looking for the business world and corporations and pragmatism. And when pragmatism becomes a substitute for biblical polity, we get what we do, what we've got right now. And I'm not trying to preach and I'm not trying to get on a rant here, but that's what's happened, sadly. And we can have charitable differences. You know, Jordan's more of a John Bunyan guy. I'm more of a William Kiffin guy. And that's fine. You know, we're still brothers in Christ, and I think we still have the same aims and goals. And that's okay that he's wrong and I'm right, you know, but we are to show grace to each other. But I think we need to really start committing ourselves. Last thing I'll say, and then I'm done for this evening because I don't want to, you know, filibuster here. But our Baptist associations used to do circular letters And in our little Kiffin Room meeting, we read about Andrew Fuller, about the decline of revival and the need, the decline of religion, the need for revival. And, you know, I was there this past year down in Nashville, and I heard Vision 2025, which is, was a regurgitation of what we've heard in the last 50 years, basically. And in this letter from Fuller, you know what he talked about? You need to go to prayer meeting. You need to go to your members' meetings. You need to go attend worship and the ordinances. You need to pray. You need to be in the Word. You need to grow in holiness. That's how we'll see revival. And he talked about how religion had declined. You know, we need to get serious about things as Baptists. We've been on this train about what's popular and what's pragmatic for too long, and we're off the rails. And the solution is not to just keep doubling and tripling down on all this stuff. It's to get back to our roots. And I would be glad to see more people of a Kiffin spirit, a Bunyan spirit, a Spurgeon spirit in our midst than what we've got today. So other than that, I have no opinions or no thoughts.
Getting back to take up the ordinary meetings and the extraordinary grace. Now, so we've been going on for a while, but I want to give Jesse and John, you guys have a chance to give any closing comments. And maybe Connor, too. I'll give you a shot, too. So, Jesse, do you have any closing thoughts or comments?
Well, I think Jake's right. I mean, historically, I think you want to be asking, is the Lord's Supper a church ordinance? I mean, I think that is the key question. And I think you might say that of baptism as well, so that we're not partaking of the Lord's Supper at church camp and ideally not baptizing at church camp either. So, I mean, I think the church ordinance thing is the key thing. So if you read, or were to go back and read Helwys, Thomas Helwys, or you to read even John Smith, I know he goes astray, but if you read his Character of the Beast, he's getting right at these things of baptism and the Lord's Supper as being church ordinances. And so I think Jake's point there is really important. And I think if we're going to really reflect on these things, and even what he said about if baptism is a prerequisite to partaking of the Lord's Supper, and if we don't think someone is rightly baptized, and this is a church ordinance, I think that's significant. And that really is the essence of what the Baptist argument was or has been for at least in the 17th century. I mean, in the early 17th century, and again, thinking about Smith and Helwys, I mean, that's like 1609, 1610, 1611. So really early on. So I think thinking about it that way as being a church ordinance, the idea of covenanting together and the reason that we can partake of these ordinances and administer the ordinances is because we have covenanted together and thereby having the keys of the kingdom, having covenanted together in a covenant community. I mean, that is the way I think of considering these things.
Good stuff. Jonathan, anything to add?
Not much. Again, I think, as I mentioned earlier, if I had to err on one side, I think I'd err on the side that Jake's elucidated so well. I would say, though, in thinking through it and thinking kind of through this historically, the way that we see kind of particularly in the reformers in the mid to late 16th century and into the early 17th century talking about, you know, admission to communion, a key component that we haven't really touched on is unity and the unifying nature of the ordinance, of the sacrament. And I think a key question there for us practically then is what exactly is unifying about the Lord's Supper? And so if we're thinking about 1 Corinthians 11 and thinking about, you know, the communitarian kind of aspect there where Paul's kind of upbraiding the Corinthian church for, you know, essentially showing favoritism amongst themselves. We also then have to think about kind of 1 Corinthians 12 when Paul talks about, he's talking to the Corinthian church and saying that they are kind of members of this body of Christ. And so in thinking about that then, our unity as Christians, those who profess the gospel correctly and appropriately, biblically, our unity is in Christ around the gospel, and the ordinance in some sense is instituted for that unity so that we all may be one kind of amongst one another. So I think practically speaking, it's helpful to think about the administration of the Lord's Supper in the way Jake has said. That said, I would want to kind of place a slight pause or a slight deviation there for, and Jake does this, he's certainly not saying that, you know, we can't necessarily do this. He's just saying he wouldn't do this, but for kind of that close communion that I talked about earlier, not full open, i.e. anybody anywhere can come, this is a converting ordinance, but that close, anybody who's who professes the gospel correctly and biblically may come to the Lord's Supper, because ultimately we are united in the body of Christ. And this, in some sense, this meal is a representation of that unity. It certainly does other things, but it's not less than this kind of unifying ordinance.
Good stuff. Now, Connor, you have the floor.
Yeah, I don't have really anything to add. I mean, this has been a really, maybe two things. One, this has been a really good exercise for me, so appreciate you guys hopping on and giving your wisdom and stories and storytelling. It's been very fruitful and beneficial, so thank you. And secondly, I just have something to say to Jake. Jake, you're more than welcome. You know, if you submit to our elders and you want to move up here, we'd love to have you as a member. And you know what? I may even give you the pulpit. I might do that. We gotta sort through some things. We'll talk about it. But you know that could happen.
All I ask is for a fall and spring week of revival. That's it.
That's right. Not revivalism. Yeah. Not revivalism.
But I'll even
Connor, we're sounding a little too.
I'll even pull out my 1611.
Sounding a little too elder ruled for my comfort.
What, Jonathan?
Sounding a little too elder ruled for my comfort.
Ah, well, there's
that's another discussion.
Right?
I'm an elder rule man for the most part. So here we go.
Doesn't surprise us, Jordan. We already know that you err on Baptist polity.
That's totally Jordan. Yeah. Just for the record, we are certainly not an elder rule Baptist church.
Jordan, I feel a little bad. I feel like we kind of bulldozed the whole open communion view. There are some really, really strong defenses of the open communion view. I don't want to pretend like it doesn't have its strong points. I feel like our conversation was pretty strongly in favor of a close or closed communion perspective. But Daniel Turner's work I mentioned earlier, A Modest Plea, you can find it for free online. It's written in the late 1700s. You should be able to find it for free. It's really strong, and it's actually surprisingly clear. So if you're out there listening to this somewhere and think, oh, old documents are hard to read, maybe the 17th century documents are hard to read. The 18th century documents are really quite comprehensible. And so that work by Daniel Turner, he basically takes stuff from John Collett Ryland and kind of revises it. And it's I think, in my opinion, it's one of the best cases for open communion. And it kind of hinges on the verse, you know, in Romans 14, you know, we should not exclude those whom Christ has welcomed. And I think there's something really strong and powerful about that, and even kind of beautiful about that, even though I don't personally hold to that. I agree with that verse. Too. I don't personally hold to that practice.
Clarification.
I would just put out there again, I know we've like mainly focused on history here tonight, but I do think, like I was trying to reiterate before, that like the biblical pressure here, it's not just a historical argument we're trying to make, but like we genuinely believe that the biblical pressure, at least most of us here, is for the close communion view, because it's all about the proper and the biblical administration of the sacraments, and those being enjoyed in the context of local churches. So
That's good. Thanks, Cody. I think that's an appropriate way to end it. While we did focus primarily, I guess, on historical and theological argumentation, we do want to be people of the book, right? We want to be biblical exegetes, biblical scholars, in all the right senses, not in a biblicistic way. Jake, yeah, what you got?
Last thing to tag on what you said, to remember that as Baptists, we are a people of the blood, the book, and the blessed hope.
Can you clip that so that the episode closes out with that?
Yeah.
That's if someone's listened this far and is not a Baptist, do you know?
you, They're converted. they have converted.
It'll either be here or on the other side of glory, but yeah.
Oh man, here we go.
I do want to take note though that Jake talked about not being sentimental, and then he got sentimental and said, "Connor, I don't like open communion, but I'll go to your church." And he doesn't have a good reason for that. It's sentimental. I was trying to
use an illustration to help. Of course, if he got me up there, we'd get the church on the right track in that sense. So.
The illustration might not be the reality, though, it sounds like.
All right, well, I'm going to close out this recording with, for those who've been listening, we appreciate you tuning in, and hopefully this has been helpful to at least think through some of the issues, to give you some ideas, something to chew on. And I'm going to try to put in the notes, you know, we talked about Dag and Kiffin and Turner and some other people. I'm going to try to put that in there so you can have access to those easily. But we appreciate you tuning in. Hopefully you found something to chew on, to think about, and we look forward to hearing from you in the future. Let us know questions, thoughts, as you have them. Didn't have any questions on this live episode, which is a little bit of a bummer, but hopefully if we do them in the future, we'll have more questions and opportunity for you to tune in and to, I guess, join the show. So thanks for everybody for listening. This has been the only, an episode of the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, and we'll talk to you guys soon.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.